Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. This is episode number 40. And as it's number 40, we thought we should get a really special guest on the show. Now, we tried for Archie, but he was unavailable. We then thought, well, who else should we go for? We thought, let's try for Tim Mosso. But it turns out he's really busy recording new YouTube content with TGV.
And going to law school,
allegedly. So we thought, well, let's aim higher than that. Let's go to the main man. Now, I'm going to be very careful in introducing this person because those of you that listen to the podcast know that I have struggled in recent weeks somewhat on his name. So, without further ado, we do not have Roger Moore on the show.
No.
We do not have Atom Moore on the show.
No.
We do not have Ariel Atom on the show, because that's a car.
That's a car, yes.
But we do have Ariel Adams on the show. Hey, I got that right. Welcome,
well
Ariel.
Done. That was pretty good, actually. Good to be on the show. I know the people you're talking about. I know Archie and I know Tim very well, and I think they would have made very good guests, but I'm honored to have been asked by you to be on the show. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, we are very honored that you chose to accept our invitation. So yeah,
yes.
Welcome to the show. So tell me, Ariel, there's one question that both myself as a Richard and Ricky as also a Richard, who going through school, because our names were able to be shortened to something not terribly pleasant, led us from time to time to wonder why our parents called us this and did they really love us? So, from two people whose names shortened to Dick, tell us what it's like being called Ariel growing up in high school.
Well, I want to add that my father's name was also Richard. And, I called him Rich growing up, so that's another variation there. You know, actually, high school was fine. It was in elementary school, because in second grade, that's when Disney's The Little Mermaid came out. And you know what boys are like in second grade? We're a little bit emotional. And when people start, you know, singing Disney songs to you and essentially inferring that you're a girl, and a redhead girl for that matter, and also a mythical creature, it's easy to laugh as an adult. But as a kid, boy, is that hurtful. So I still today, like, I'll go to the gym and sometimes people will like kind of like hum the like some a song from The Little Mermaid. And I'm like, how do people even remember this music? It's been interesting because growing up, I knew that my name was like a dude's name. Like, because in Israel, like, Ariel is like Steve, right?
Absolutely.
Ah.
But as we know, there's been a co-opting of male names by women. Oddly, not the other way around. I don't know a lot of men who were named Jennifer. But we just sort of accept that if it's, you know, it's good enough for us, then someone else might like to borrow it. As an adult, I've appreciated it, but yeah, it wasn't amazing as a kid all the time in terms of my name, but you know, better than making fun of my name than other things, right? No one called me ugly, so that's good.
I did wonder whether it was that your parents were like Shakespearean English majors who were fans of the theatre or something, that you'd somehow acquired this name because it was their favourite character in
Shakespearean plays. I'll explain
it.
It's a biblical name in Hebrew. The name translates. Yes. It's a contraction between the Hebrew word for lion and the Hebrew word for God. And my understanding is that it implies some type of lion guardian of the deity.
Yes. As it turns out, I actually do know that.
Oh, well, there you go. And so did Shakespeare, apparently.
Absolutely. No, that's good. Well, it's great to have you on the show. So, tell us.
Does that mean we can use Under the Sea's intro music, though?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Brilliant.
Get the sound of bubbles, you know, like bubbles underwater.
The bubbles.
Yeah, like in SpongeBob or something.
So, every time there's any swearing in the show tonight, it will be bleeped out using the sound effect of bubbles and any other Disney items that we can find.
Yeah, every time a curse word's like, do-do-do-do-do. Hey, whatever goes in your market, you let me know, and I'll use that term. I love hearing about, like UK offensive language, because it sounds very innocent and kind of charming in America, though it's quite offensive, you know, where you live. So we're kind of amused by that.
And Scotland is the home of that kind of language, where you can use all of the any swear word you can think of can be used as a term of endearment in Scotland.
Yes.
Like literally any swear word you can think of with the right timbre and tone given to it can be used as a term of endearment.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Sometimes it doesn't translate terribly well.
So, watches in Scotland, tell me tell me what defines watch taste in Scotland. I know everyone has a slightly different taste. There's no one type of aesthetic that works for the entire market. But if you had to go in the world and say, people in Scotland overwhelmingly like this type of design, this type of theme, this type of history, what would it be? Educate me, because I've not been fortunate enough to come to your land yet.
Shitty tags.
Okay, shitty tags.
Yeah, that's probably, probably the mass market is on every corner there is a tag boutique somewhere selling them. We have in Glasgow a very famous arcade. Have you been to London?
Yes.
So you'll be familiar with the Burlington Arcade?
Yes, of course.
So there is a similar sort of arcade in Glasgow where all of the ADs bar a couple reside. So any main watch you can get in that arcade, which means that everything else that exists in all of the shopping centres tends to be just for those brands that will give an authorised dealership to anybody, which means that it's which means that it's Tag and Bremont and to a lesser extent Tudor. But yeah, there's a lot of Tag Heuer availability in certainly in our part of Scotland. But I wouldn't say there was an... Would you say, Ricky, that there was an overall aesthetic other than Rolex?
No, it's across the board. But what you do is people tend to gravitate towards Tag. They don't care if it's quartz. They just want a Tag. And then they grow a brain a little bit and they upgrade perhaps to Rolex. And then they realise there's more in the world than Rolex. And it just goes from there.
So it sounds to me like you guys don't have any problem with Tag Heuer, but you have a problem with some of the people that wear Tag Heuer in your area.
Considering that we only started speaking merely 5 minutes ago, you've sussed this show out pretty quickly. I don't know where to go with that, to be honest, as a Tag owner.
I think we're all Tag owners, actually.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Speak for yourselves. But no, it's across the board. I mean, over here, Scotland doesn't have the population density of even, I think, what, London's got more people in it than the whole of Scotland put together,
yeah,
is that right?
Pretty much, yeah.
So it is small. Big country, small amount of people, and it's across the board. There's loads of G-Shock collectors, there's people getting into vintage now. But between Glasgow and Edinburgh, that kind of the M8 motorway that joins the two of them together, between those two, you've got pretty much all the watch stuff in the country, with a couple of sporadic things in Aberdeen, Inverness, and maybe Glen Eagles as well. So it's a small fry, and that's why we've obviously started our website, podcast, those kind of things, to try and give a place for people that are interested or want to get into watches who maybe don't know that there is a scene, an industry, and a community out there.
And there is a surprising number of Scottish people actually involved in the watch industry. If you take the likes of Brian Duffy at Watches of Switzerland, there are quite a lot of designers in a number of these big watch brands that actually are Scottish, as we are finding out, because we didn't realise that when we started. We just did this because it seemed like a good idea at the time. And the world has opened. The world is our oyster. Cue an Under the Sea reference.
Yes, or a cease and desist from Rolex.
Oh, yes. did you get one of those already?
Not yet.
Oh, you guys haven't lived. It's like a rite of passage. You need to get a cease and desist for something random that you've done.
So how many have you had?
Only one. And the thing was, it was one of those like automated ones where like no one even made the decision, and then I actually sent it to them and they apologized.
Right.
I'm not allowed to discuss like why it was, and it was just like kind of a humorous thing. But it's totally a rite of passage. But I wanted to ask, because you two obviously like watches and know watches, what like brands or models or whatever do you like hope that your community liked more? Like if they were exposed to it, if they knew about it, you'd know they'd like it, but they haven't quite done it yet. Like what do you want to see popular in your city?
I think the thing here is we're supposed to interview you.
Oh, I'm so bad at turning off.
And I'm like, what's going on? No, you're right. I don't know. You take this one, Rick.
Well, there are a number of not big brands, not necessarily large sellers of watches, but there are a couple of very well-known, obviously real top-end brands that don't exist in Scotland. There is no buddy selling
Richard
them.
Mille.
So the likes of Richard, yeah, okay, I wasn't really thinking that, but the likes of A. Lange and Zona. So you can't buy an ALS in Scotland. You would have to go to England to do that. Ulysses Nardin. I would love to... you're never going to see a lot of these watches on people. De Bethune. I would love to see somebody... Because I've never even seen one in the flesh. And while I'll never buy one, and I'll probably not ever know anyone that owns one, I would love to be able to wander into an AD and actually just see some of the technical stuff that these watches seem to be doing. They just look absolutely gorgeous. Ricky is the one who travels the world and goes to the Baselworlds and the SIHHs.
Well, the thing is, our American listeners love to hear that it only costs us the equivalent of $100 return plane from Scotland to Switzerland, so we can go to Basel and SIHH in a day and come back.
Yes,
that's very affordable. That's very affordable.
It's awesome. It's really good.
It is genuinely the case that it is cheaper to get a flight, if you book far enough in advance, from Edinburgh Airport to Geneva return than it would be to park all day in a car park in Edinburgh in order to go round the authorised dealers in Edinburgh and shop there. Yeah. So yeah, it's actually marginally cheaper to go to Switzerland and buy your watches than possibly it is in Scotland. And obviously over there you can see everything. But the thing we've noticed about the watch community and the kind of red bar stuff, etc., that's starting to happen in Scotland is there is quite a big group of, quite a lot of vintage guys. There's quite a lot of folk that have very large, not necessarily collections of world famous, you know, astronomically priced vintage watches, but just really solid collections that have been putting together for years quietly in their bedroom, and now they've got an opportunity to show it off and talk about it and scratch that particular itch.
It's kind of like when a city has those fancier watches, it's sort of a sense like the city's made it, and you feel like our city's important, it's made it, it can potentially sustain these sales, we want to see it here too. It's sort of a local pride element as well as an horological appreciative element. Would you not agree?
Yeah, there is definitely the case that because of the way that the watch shops are concentrated in Glasgow, that there is a bit of competition between them all. It's just who gets what. And the brands, when they move authorised dealer, they're literally moving to the guy next door or the guy around the corner because everybody's in the same place. So yeah, there is a bit of pride taken. And certainly we know that ALS is coming to Scotland and there has been a bit of a battle, as we understand it, as to who's getting it. So there is certainly a bit of play between all the guys that are in the retail market. And quite a lot of the big groups are controlled from Scotland now, even those that are expanding into England, the likes of Chisholm Hunter, who you'll no doubt never have heard of. But they're expanding rapidly in the UK and they're effectively a Scottish company, and some of the others as well.
Have you been to Scotland yourself?
Me? No, I've never been to Scotland. I'd love to, but I've never been there yet.
So when are you coming over?
I don't have an itinerary planned out just now, but I know that, what do I need to do in Scotland? I need to see some of the Highlands because I love the nature, what I see. I'm not a golfer, but I am curious to know where golf was created. You happen to have a couple castles, I hear. And
yes.
There's this brown liquid called scotch I hear good things about. And it's best in your land, so I'd like to try some of that stuff.
Haggis?
No, thank you.
Okay, moving on.
Tablet and shortbread, that's the other thing. Iron Brew. Have you heard of Iron Brew?
Shortbread, yes. Iron Brew, no. What is that? I'm afraid to ask.
That is the only...
Blood?
It's not quite the case. Yeah. It's not quite the case that it's... But it's basically the only drink in the world that outsells Coca-Cola in any free market. So you can go to any country in the world and the biggest soft drink sold is Coca-Cola, except in Scotland.
Are you in the soft drink industry? This is some interesting statistic.
No, I'm not in the soft drink industry. It's just a well-known Scottish fact. It's also the case in like North Korea and stuff where they don't let you sell Coca-Cola. But in every country in the world, Coca-Cola is the largest moving soft drink, except in Scotland, where it is this orange drink called Iron Brew. And the only thing you can say about Iron Brew and what it tastes like is that Iron Brew tastes like Iron Brew. But it is also the closest, it's probably the closest thing we have come to a cease and desist notice from Rolex, because we produced an Iron Brew bezeled, because the colours are kind of this orange and blue. So we produced this pastiche of a Iron Brew bezeled Rolex to go alongside the Batman and the Pepsi. Which proved quite popular, one of our most popular posts on Instagram.
Yeah, they were Photoshop mock-ups. And Iron Brew, to give you an example of just how much it's loved in this country, they changed the recipe about a year or two ago to remove a lot of the sugar content.
Uh-huh.
And there are batches of cans of the original recipe that sells now for about $10 a can.
I got an even better story for you. So there was a there was a soft drink, I think it was relaunched in America, called Tab, T-A-B.
Tab Clear?
Yeah, Tab Clear.
Uh-huh. And there was a particular ingredient, this was about 20 years ago, I think, and there was a particular ingredient which was found to be harmful for your health. And so they stopped, they stopped making it. And stores which carried the drink had these, like, we got to get rid of this sales. So the stuff was selling for an extremely, you know, small amount of money because they're trying to liquidate it. And the irony is that people were, like, fighting to get the Tab, even though it was conspicuously stated that there are ingredients in there known to be harmful to health. And it was the funniest thing because it was like, it's not that people were ignoring it, but they were more incentivized by the cheap price and the fact that it could be bad for you, which was kind of amazing.
And that sounds like the kind of drink that would go down well in Scotland, because fundamentally all we make in Scotland nowadays is stuff that's bad for you. So it's either got too much sugar in it or it's got too much alcohol in it. That's pretty much the national product of Scotland.
I'm actually liking the colors. I think this sort of orange and blue and white theme would look kind of nice. I'm looking at it online here. So who got angry? Was it Iron Brew or was it Rolex?
No, none of them got angry yet.
Oh, yeah.
But that's only because we've got a
wee
tight...
We're
not big enough. They've not noticed us yet. But we'll keep pushing the Iron Brew bezel Rolex.
But, you know,
and see how long it
takes. Of it this way. You said yourself that this is a popular drink in your country and people know the colors. Now, if you took these colors and you put it on a watch, you know that there's a good chance if the watch was attractive, it would sell. Why? Because it creates an emotional connection between a people and its place and something that they know. And then go anywhere in the world and stare at their wrist, not only think of home, but think of something that is endemic to home. And that's one of the sort of wonderful ways that a watch can serve you outside of telling the time or looking good or anything like that. It's an interesting thing, that sort of emotions that we can add to our timepiece.
Well, this week I picked up an orange Everest rubber band for my Batman. So when that gets put on, that will be the Iron Brew colours.
That's very true.
That's actually very cool. I look forward to seeing that.
I will tag you in an Instagram post. But that leads on to, we should be doing an audio wrist check, and our guest always goes first. So, Ariel, what are you wearing today?
Oh my gosh, I'm recording a show, so I don't have a watch on me, but I'm looking at my desk. I got a bunch of watches. Somebody dropped off today about 10 or 15 different watches that I have to go through. Uh-huh. It's actually interesting because I get overwhelmed sometimes and I just get a bunch of watches and sometimes I don't even know what they are. So I have some bags here and I open it up and I'm like, what's inside of here? I got, what's a cool one I have? Zenith recently released a limited edition for the US. It's red, white, and blue color. It's the Chrono Tipo.
Yes.
That's pretty cool. That's one of the ones I have here. Here's a watch that was sent from the EU, and they disregarded our instructions to not send a real alligator strap. So after being delayed in customs, we had this choice. They said, okay, you have a choice. We can send the watch back to Europe, or you can apply for a CITES license, because Fish and Wildlife, because you're bringing in what they call an exotic strap, or we can take the strap and we can destroy it and send you the strap in pieces. So I have a watch here. There's a destroyed strap and just the watch, you know, case without the strap on there. Which, again, if I didn't know the story about what that is, I'd be like, why is there just an empty watch without a strap being sent to me? But that's part of the interesting side that people don't know about how these watches move around the world. It's one of the complexities, because most things can be shipped, but watches do not move across borders as easily as we'd like to think they might, because that would quite drastically change the economy.
Ask the boys at Fratello, they'll tell you all about it.
Are you allowed to name the brand that sent you the alligator strapped watch?
It's a new brand. It's called Kensin, and what's special about them is they developed a 7750 that has an annual calendar complication. So I was pretty excited about checking it out. Even though
I reviewed that watch a couple of weeks ago. When I say reviewed, I mean I read the press release
and retyped it
and made some inquiries of them, because they're not yet sending me watches. But it's very, very cool.
Yeah,
it's
but
a
the
very
funny thing
interesting
is,
interesting layout.
The hour hand and the minute hand are almost identical in size and shape.
Yes, but it doesn't sit in a normal fashion. I'm just trying to picture it in my head because I've not got it obviously sitting in front of me. But the day and the date don't run on the normal planes.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. That's hilarious. They just threw like the buckle, so the strap is obviously distorted. They just like they threw the buckle in there. I imagine like these guys in customs, you know, they see all kinds of stuff. When they see these watches once in a while, I wonder what they make of it. They sit there, they take pictures and show it on their own Instagram, like, you know, because sometimes, you know, these people, like, I think of the security guards at the stores, you know, the stores. And the boutiques, obviously, there's a lot of expensive stuff there. And it's funny to talk to security guards to figure out which one of them have become sort of watch lovers just as a function of working in a watch store. I think there's a special thing about just being around them. It's like that's a great way of getting people into watches, just sort of throwing them in the mix and letting them idly look.
So what are you wearing, Rick? Ricky. I'm Rick. You're Ricky.
You're Rick. Hi, Ricky here. I'm just wearing my Batman again.
Are you? Okay. Well,
boring.
Boring. Shall we play my game that we invented in the last podcast? Because you know fine well what I'm wearing, and you get fed up with me wearing it.
Oh, it's a Tag Heuer, right?
No. Guess what he's wearing? It is something you could buy, and as soon as you buy it, it is worth about half the money you paid originally, maybe Italian.
So wait, what watch is it?
I'm wearing a Panerai.
Oh.
But the problem is that it's all I ever wear, despite the fact that I have other watches. So Ricky keeps on getting fed up with me wristwatch checking exactly the same watch on every episode. And we do two of these a week, so everybody else is getting bored. So we started a new game, which is I open my watch box and you pick a number between 1 and 7, and I'll tell you what watch it is. And then I'll just pretend that that's actually the watch I'm wearing. So Ariel, why don't you do the honours and pick a number between 1 and 7?
I have a feeling that they're all Panerais.
You know me too.
He has
well.
Listened to this show before.
No, I haven't. It just dawned upon me. That's probably where the joke is going.
No. To be fair, that would be a better joke. But this isn't actually a joke. This is just the way it goes.
Do we need to talk that you only have 7 watches? We need to up your game here a little bit.
It's not that I only have 7. It's that the watch case I've got sitting beside me, which is a little watch case, has 7 in it. There is a briefcase in the corner, courtesy of Richemont Group, that is slightly more loaded, but I can't reach it from where I'm sitting. So
it'd be funny if it was like choose a number between like 1 and like 87 or something like that.
I don't know your personal status. I don't know if it's discussed. Are you married? In a relationship?
I'm married.
Free and single. And so we've asked this of a few guests in the past. Obviously, you work in the watch world, so I imagine your wife probably already knows how this all goes down, but does she know how many watches you have that are actually yours? Or do you sometimes pretend that the watch you've actually got isn't actually yours, that it's one that you've just been loaned, but actually it's yours and you just spent too much money getting another watch?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I've never been the type of person to have to ask other people's permission buying a watch, but I know that a lot of people do. And I think to myself, how many more watches would people buy each year if they didn't have to ask their significant other for permission first? I think it stops a lot of potential sales, right? Because I hear this all the time. A guy's like, I have to figure out what I can buy my wife so she's okay with this purchase. I'm like, so in order to get her okay with you spending money, you're going to spend even more money?
More money.
You know, I think that my wife appreciates that it is my business. And because I work within it, if I buy watches from time to time, it's not as weird as though I was buying something that from a hobby that wasn't necessarily part of my work. So I have maybe a much better excuse than most people. But yeah, if we're in an argument, I definitely get out of the blue something about me buying watches. Like completely random. We're not even talking about it. Da, 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 da. But you buy yourself watches. I'm like, I buy like 2 a year and it's my industry. Like it's the least I could do. Give back a tiny little bit.
Oh, I can just imagine. I can just imagine those conversations when that's being thrown at you. and you've got nothing. You're sitting there. You've got nothing to say back.
Yeah, I mean, what for most, like, I'll just say husbands, I think that we need to help them with a good diplomatic response to, why do you need this? Why do you need this watch? Not why do you need this? What's the response? We need to give the listeners some type of material that they can use.
Well, what they can say is, do you really need to have 20 pairs of shoes?
Oh, that's good. Throw it back on them a little bit.
Do you need 10 handbags?
This is from, I should say, Ariel, this is from a man that's single that's saying this. He knows nothing. He knows nothing of what would
I
happen
have had if you mentioned in the past.
If you mentioned the shoes. He doesn't understand.
No, I know a lot.
I think we need to take more of the Douglas Adams approach, I feel, like by identifying the, you know, the secret of life, the universe and everything, more of a kind of 40, actually 42 is the number.
Yep.
So we're striving to get to 42 watches. And once you reach 42, that's it. It's done. It's complete. The circle is complete. The answer to life, the universe and everything.
Well, I think Ariel's avoided the question of a number between 1 and 7 to start with.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I'm going to go with 2.
2. Hold on a second. Oh, it's a goodie. It's a goodie.
Is it?
I
picked that last episode.
Did you? I don't remember. It is the Gorilla.
Which one?
The Wandering Hours... GT
Fastback. A fun watch. Honestly, a fun watch. I think Octavio did a great job. He was obsessed with the Star Wheel when he was at AP, and it had been his mission for years to make one that wasn't, you know, a ridiculous sum of money. And he did it. And he did it with Vache. And you know what? I think it's a very successful product. I love when watches like that come out, even if they're not for some people. These are the type of watches that we should champion, that should be made more of.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of unusual time-telling complications. That's my particular itch. Not that I've been able to scratch it that much in my watch purchases, but I think as my collection develops, I'm finding that that's the route I'm going down, is unusual time-telling complications rather than straightforward three-handers, unless it's a Panerai, of course, in which case you just buy it because it's cool.
So apart from the one that Rick's just mentioned there, the Gorilla, what other watches would you say maybe in the last year have stood out like that are a bit different, a bit out there that people should look at?
Well, I will sort of answer the question this way, and I will talk about this notion of the enthusiast-run or operated or started watch brand. And I've been doing some talks about this and writing about this, and I tried to identify why is it that very seasoned and knowledgeable watch lovers are finding interest in these little startup brands. And I already answered the question, and that is because I think they are run by people that like watches. And if you like watches, you know the difference between like a big group brand who has a CEO that came from a makeup company or selling shoes and all of a sudden find themselves in the watch industry not being product lovers. And we can identify the difference between that and a brand that was run by someone like watches. You know, Jean-Claude Biver, he's basically out of the industry now, but he's a good example of a product guy. He likes watches before he's a watch manager. And being a watch manager and liking watches offered interesting products. You may not like them all, but you recognize that they're original and they're trying to do something different. So when it comes to the small brands these days, like the Gorillas, you have these brands run by people who are making products for themselves. And the results are very uniquely satisfying because they're not designed by committee. No one has a spreadsheet that says, oh, we need to be within this price range and these are the competitor models and it should be the size. Like when those products come out, you know, people like us, we look at it and we're just ultimately not very satisfied because it's not created by a creative director. It's created by a matrix. And so for me, the way I'm answering the question, there's a watch that is released by someone that loves watches and is making a watch to their specifications. That, for me, is extremely satisfying.
So who do you see coming through on the rails that is the up-and-comers that are maybe not even released their first watch, but that because of where you are in the industry you see, or they are so under the radar? One guy that springs to mind from my point of view is the guy Carell at Barrowhand. I don't know if you've come across him.
Oh, I know Carell very well, personally.
Who's doing his own thing. I think he's just about ready. He keeps messaging me. I think he's just about ready to actually start making some money from them. But who else are you seeing, especially in the States? Because one of the big things that we see over here is seems to be a clamor in the United States to start producing full watches from the ground up.
You know, again, I sort of shy away from mentioning specific brands, and I more like to talk about sort of trends and things that are happening, because there's no one brand taking, you know, doing this. As you mentioned, it's sort of a lot that are clamoring to do it. You know, since Asian manufacturing has decreased when it comes to supplying the traditional industry, these factories have had excess capacity and has allowed them to provide services to, you know, small order or order makers, which has created this independent watch micro brand economy as we see it right now. And it's emboldened a lot of people to thinking, I can do the same thing as the big brands, but I can do it for less, which is true and false at the same time. People are able to get relatively simple, often generic types of designs done cheaply and effectively. But once they want to get closer to the quality that you see from a lot of the European brands to make their own movements, to make their own cases, they start to see how complicated things are. And they start to run into some of the issues like volume. There's companies that will make cases, but are they going to make 100? Not when they have another, you know, customer that's ordering 10,000. And so one of the issues that a lot of the people misunderstand is not whether you can do it from a practical perspective, but whether there's a company willing to do it. And the economy required, the economy of scale required, and the dedication and the attention to detail to make a product that, you know, enthusiasts, you know, will put our seal of approval on is a lot harder than a lot of these entrepreneurs think. So you brought up Corel, for example, who I've known for years now. And Corel with Barrel Hand had this amazing concept. He wanted to make, you know, a new watch. He created his own kind of like homage or work. And it was all great. But what he basically found was that all the companies he would go to try to get the actual machining work done would either say no or would say, you know, it's crazy. You want too much finishing, da-da-da-da-da. I was just with Timex in the last year meeting with some of the factories that are doing the American Documents watch. And, you know, Timex hasn't made watches in America in generations. And so what people don't understand is that they had to relearn watchmaking in-house. Their factory in Connecticut, it's not even a factory. It's a distribution center and offices. They actually had to carve a corner to have like watchmakers. And I visited some of these factories that, you know, producing the cases and stuff for them. And it's like a battle. It's like, guys, this polishing sucks. Guys, what are you doing? This, you know, the tolerance is here. And the factories, they're driven mad because the tolerances required for a watch much of the time is more demanding than medical devices and more demanding than military equipment. It's some of the most demanding tolerances anywhere. And it drives the factory workers bonkers. Why? Because it's a tiny volume. So there's still a lot of hurdles that the independent community needs to reach. And it's really only through development and rapid prototyping where you can democratize, you know, CNC machining and things like that, which will be revolutionary. But still today, if you want metal watches and you want the finishing to be good, you have to go through a more traditional manufacturing process. And it's expensive. It requires a lot of investment and a lot of fighting with factories to get what you want.
So do you think you'll see consolidation eventually in some of these owner-operator brands?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct that only by working together can this turn into an industry. And we have to look at Switzerland and recognize that for generations, even though the brands were, I'll call them competitive, the suppliers were working for the same goals. The suppliers were supplying the same brands. They were working together. They needed to support one another. And the Swiss government helps in a lot of ways. In America, we see a little bit of that. But what happens is that, one, when everyone's sort of poor and sort of, you know, pulling themselves along and being bootstrapped, they all want to help one another. The moment real money enters the picture, you have egos, you have fights, you have people offering to buy others. And, you know, look at what the Swatch Group and Richemont have done in Switzerland, where they purchased up suppliers that had a democratic approach to who they were serving, now gave 80% of their time or 100% of the time to their owner, if not completely abandoning other clients altogether. And these types of economics, you know, they find their way in there. And I think that in order for what you're talking about to happen successfully, people need to agree on what a long-term vision looks like. And right now, it's someone's fault, but no one knows what the traditional watch industry is going to look like in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. We have a feeling it's going to be around. Like when we look at a mechanical watch, we know two things immediately. Nobody needs it, and it's beautiful, and we want it. And I think people will feel that way 20 years from now. But I try to remind people that we are on the last generation of individuals who remember what life was like needing a watch, as opposed to growing up with a watch being a status item, a desire item. And so for me, the mentality, which is going to drive watch demand and sales 20 years from now, is going to be very different than it is today, because you'll have no more collective memory of what it was like to need this item as a tool. And I think that's going to drastically change the future. And when it comes to these small brands in terms of manufacturing, production, design, whatever, there's still so much unknowns about what's all going to mean in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point and a very good phrase about, you know, nobody needs it, but everybody wants it because it looks great when they see it. How do you think that, as well as the consolidation or the cooperation within the watch manufacturing bleeds over to what's happening with watch media, because there's now people starting to make just as much money in the watch media realm as there is in actually trying to make watches, and it's probably not quite as stressful as trying to actually make the things. Where do you see, I mean, we've been at this for a few months, and even in the space that we've been doing this, there's X number. I mean, we're not making any money. That's not what we've set out to do. But obviously yourselves at a Blog to Watch, you're a very successful organisation. You've got your competitors stroke colleagues at the likes of Hodinkee and Revolution in the Rake. How do you see that all shaking out? We've seen yesterday what's happened with Watch, Box and TGV. They've got together. That's the first, or one of the first, big consolidations, if you like.
That's an incredibly, you know, salient question right now, and it's actually a challenging area because watch media is threatened. We're a species that is endangered because of the economics. Now, the problem is that watch brands are kind of obsessed with this notion of control. They don't like the idea of people being able to say what they want to about their products. And they feel that watch media is reliant on them, which gives them the confidence to tell watch media what to do. So if you want to be independent watch media like a Blog to Watch, it happens only through persistence and fighting and stubbornness and asserting constantly to the team what our values are and what our mission is. And we always ask ourselves the question, are we serving our customer? And our customer is the audience. Even though we're not paid by our audience, they are ultimately who we're trying to satisfy and to serve, because we feel that they are where our value is. They are our primary asset. Now, other media doesn't necessarily look at it that way. They see it more as, how do I monetize my audience? And they forget that without producing compelling content, that you no longer have the authority to speak about the topics you're speaking about. You're more a marketing channel. And marketing and media are related, but, you know, marketing and editorial are distinct things. And so the problem is that you have more and more people who are more than happy to accept their opinion being purchased as opposed to their opinion being earned. I sympathize with them because it's not easy to make money in media, because you have to not only defend the independence of your voice, but you also have to promote the value of your audience. And watch brands these days, given the instability of the market, they don't want to spend like they used to spend. In fact, most of them can't, because their budgets have been slashed. So there is not an economy that allows for independent, high quality, authoritative watch media to exist. If you want to be in watch media, the easy way, not necessarily the wise way, but the easy way is to either sell your opinion or start to sell products to your audience. And I've done a personal study of, you know, media over the last 100 years, and I've identified that there's very few, if any, examples of media being both a store and an independent voice. You are either an independent voice or a store. You can choose either one. So I see a lot of media today actually turning more into a store, which has a different inherent relationship with the readers or the audience or whatever you want to call it, than someone who is a news source and an opinion source. So for us, it's important to remain editorialists as opposed to salespeople. And I feel bad because a lot of consumers, especially those new to watches, are mystified. They start going online, they'll go on Google, they'll go on YouTube, they'll go on Instagram. They see so many different voices saying so many different things. There's almost an initial shock that happens where they don't know what to make of it. And I'm not really sure, as a media owner, how to curate that experience for people, because it's almost as though they're going to see a lot of low quality information, deceptive information, agenda-based information, before they see something from someone who's like, look, I just want to share with you why I like watches and what I like. I want you to make your own decision about it, but, you know, I want you to benefit from what I know that you don't know yet. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so where I know exactly what you're saying, what I'm really interested in is the journey that you've taken, because there will obviously have been several crossroads, and I imagine they happen fairly regularly because of the media voice you've got, of brands coming, and of you being able to take the easy road, if you like, because I imagine that keeping everything together by just being editorialist is a much more difficult than just saying, actually, we'll just do a limited edition of 600 of these and we'll make $1,000 in each of them. That's us sorted for the wage bill for the next 3 months.
Yes, it definitely has to do with why I started to begin with. And I'll answer your question in a moment, but I will generally say that I did not begin this as a business. It turned into a business, whereas many others began with, for lack of a better term, a business plan. And I am, my background is being a lawyer, and I also favor things like academics and the consultative approach to educating people, whereas others more prefer a hierarchical, authoritative approach, which, for example, I remember like reading GQ magazine. It's like, this is the suit that you have to wear this season. There's no there's no explanation of why. There's no discussion of the options. It's just like, we're telling you that this is the hot suit to wear this season. I'm like, I don't want to be told what to do and what's good. I don't want to be just given that information so I can be, you know, sheep, so to say. I want to be given choices, and I want to be given information about what's available so that I can make a decision myself. And that's what I did when I started the website in 2007. It was an ability for me to reach other people such as you know, people like yourself that share a passion. And I want to talk about why I like things. I wanted to bring new things to the picture. Hey, guys, have you heard about this watch? Hey, have you thought about this? And in that, I became a critic, where I was able to take a watch as a functional item and be able to evaluate it from a perspective of build quality, legibility, practicality, aesthetics, because I guess I have a little bit of background in art, and I was able to sort of, and a little bit of a fascination in engineering, so I was able to pull it apart that way. But my goal has always been to create other watch lovers. That's my goal. I want almost like an evangelical watch lover. I want to create mm-hmm. other people like me, but I'm not interested in directing, you know, their course as a collector. I don't say to them like, yo, these are the first three watches you got to have. I mean, I think that's preposterous. But you have a lot of people that do that, which creates people who buy things, and they don't know why they're buying them. So yeah, maybe they bought the three or five watches that are the place to start, but they don't know why those watches are good in the first place. They haven't themselves become a watch lover. They become a poser. They've listened to someone else tell them how to get started without understanding what they're doing. And I don't want collecting watches to be easy. I don't want someone just to come in and with money be able to become a collector. As we know, it requires effort and experience and time. You have to be a seasoned enthusiast. You need to have an experience with a lot of different watches in order to become a true enthusiast. And so I try to engender that journey, as opposed to giving superficial and ultimately not particularly satisfying shortcuts.
Ricky, are you going to take that on? Give you a chance to speak, as soon as me and Ariel have been hogging.
No, it's been really interesting just actually listening to the way that this has developed, because we came into this chat with no agenda, no notes, nothing. We wanted to see how it was going to flow, and the information that's coming forward, the background, everything is just, it's blowing me away listening to it. So I can only imagine what it's going to be like for the listeners listening in. I've only been into this hobby 2.5 years, Rick's around about the same amount of time, and it was your videos, your audios, your website, your reviews, your articles that kind of pushed me a little bit into the way that I'm doing things. It's like, I don't care what anyone else says. I don't care what brands say. I'm going to like what I like, and I'm going to learn. And every day, if I can do a little bit more of that, then I'm doing a good thing. And you hit on a couple of points there. It's like you see it in the groups. You see it in Facebook and the forums. It's like, okay, you need a sub. You need a Speedy. But people don't know why. It's just, you need these things to become a collector. These are, you know, the cornerstones of anyone's collection, but nobody really knows why. So you hit the nail right in the head with all that. Bang on.
I was not interested in the Submariner for the first 10 years of being a watch collector. I knew about it. I respected Rolex. But I remember when I first started getting into watches, this was around 2001 or 2002, I immediately dismissed Rolex. Like, completely dismissed it. Had nothing against it, but was just like, not for me, not now. It took, again, at least 10 years before I was like, you know what? By comparing all these watches I've seen to Rolex, I can see how Rolex has done some things really well. And when I wear my Rolex watches, some days they're the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and some days they're the most boring thing I've ever seen. I admire their quality, I love the brand, but it took me that long to appreciate what they did as a virtue of seeing what everyone else did, and I could compare it to a Rolex and be like, wow, this is well made. Wow, this is very smart. Wow, this makes a lot of sense. Wow, this is comfortable. Wow, this is the right size. But it took so much to get me there. And if me, it took that long, I don't see how anyone within the course of a couple of, you know, days, weeks, months, or even just a couple of years buys a Rolex and knows what it is. I say, take your time with that Rolex. Buy a bunch of watches beforehand. If you have a Rolex, know what it is, know why it's cool. Same thing with the Speedmaster, for example. If you don't know how to appreciate the Speedmaster and what it's good at, don't buy it. In fact, don't buy anything that you can't appreciate. Don't buy anything because you think it's cool. Buy something because you like it, and I want to support what you said. You should not give two shits about what someone else thinks. If someone criticizes your watch, smile and say, I like it, you like what you like. That type of diversity makes the world go round.
Yeah, it's as if people have got a box and they just need to tick things, and there's no thought behind it at all. I realized how good Rolex was, I think, when I saw a video from the Watches TV where they got the naked watchmaker to disassemble a sub, and he was going through explaining why this is good, why that's good, why this is put this way, why this is built that way, the longevity, the way they can take knocks, the way they've been designed and engineered in a certain way. And they are a little bit bland, but there's reasons behind it. And that's when I got the understanding of that's the reason that these are this way and why they're so popular and why they've stood the test of time. I'm also quite interested to hear, you know, you said you started this, was it 12 years ago 12, you said?
Yeah, 12 years ago.
12. How did it start? Was it a WordPress blog? Was it just a couple of notes that you put online? And then how did it develop into where it is today?
It was WordPress. You know, at the time, there was a lot more, I'll just call it free help out there. If you wanted to start a blog, there was so much information about how to do it, how to design a site, the, you know, the basics of writing, the do's and don'ts. There was a very supportive community, and a lot of that content no longer exists because people were like, I'm giving away stuff for free. I need to put this behind a paywall, services, whatever. And I understand all that, but I'm just saying that 12 years ago in the blogging space, it was a lot more democratized and a lot more accessible and open than it is now. So I had never made a website before, and I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I had some friends that were doing blogging for fun. And I thought it would be an interesting escape. And I also knew some people that were doing for fun and able to make a little bit of money through the types of advertising that was available at the time. So I said, you know what, let's do it. I had just taken the bar exam. I didn't even know if I had passed the bar exam because it takes a couple of months to get the results. And I was like, you know, if I didn't pass that exam, what the hell else I'm going to do? So maybe I was starting the site kind of as a different potential career path. I didn't know. So it wasn't supposed to be a watch blog entirely, but within like a week or two, I was like, you know what? All I really want to write about is watches. You can't anticipate that you're going to have something to say about watches on a daily basis. And there was a time because I was writing for some other publications as well, like Luxist, which was a fantastic overall luxury blog that was owned by AOL. It doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. I was writing between 3 and 5 articles a day. So I was like, I was like a machine, just pumping out content. Not because I needed to pump out content. I wasn't trying to earn anything, but there were so many watches coming out. I had so much to say, and it was kind of a wonderful time. So for me, it was this exploration about reaching people, about being able to properly cover these complicated topics, because you know these watches and the stories behind them are sometimes tough to wrap your mind around. So for me, it was sometimes a game of saying, can I properly articulate what this watch is and what this watch isn't and who it's for? Because no one else was really doing it. Because most of the watch media I saw was literally taking a press release that itself was not written particularly well and regurgitating it. And I later learned that a lot of the people who write the press releases never even see the product. So, yeah. So they're sitting there trying to think about something intelligent to say about a picture. So
a very meta.
So, you know, when I started it, it was kind of this, it was the Wild West. There was so much support on the internet for becoming a blogger about anything. And the media space was totally fractured because people were looking for watches online. Many brands at the time didn't even have websites. I mean, can you think about that? You'd go to like, you know, Jaeger, and they didn't even have a website. I got in at a point where obviously the internet was very well developed, but for brands, I mean, it was like, I remember brands saying to me, we will never be on the internet. You know, like 3 years later, they have e-commerce or something like that, right? But
it's... That reminds me of how the quartz crisis nearly killed them all.
Well, this is an industry that is defined by stubbornness, right? Mm-hmm. To create a industrial base in Switzerland with a bunch of companies that all work together to produce technology that no one needs. That's stubbornness. That's one of the most amazing examples of stubbornness in maintaining tradition. However, when you mix that with marketing decisions and sales decisions and distribution decisions, bad things happen. And so what the watch industry did, which in my opinion was very bad, is they tried to take too much responsibility unto themselves. Rather than just make the watches, they tried to make decisions about marketing and sales and distribution that was never good for their cultural mentality, meaning the mindset which is related to making great traditional watches is terrible for modern notions of marketing and distribution.
And you're see something we've noticed, and we've spoken about a couple of times in the podcast, is the number of brands that are now trying to bring their sales effectively in-house. So the likes of AP doing all of their own distribution, all of their own, so it's a dedicated boutique rather than selling through ADs. Do you see that as being a continued sign of how insular the whole industry is, rather than actually using the skills that ADs have developed over the years? You know, some of these businesses are just as old as the watch companies, and yet some of these watch companies seem to be just trying to miss out the middleman just for the sake of a few more bucks, which frankly they don't need because they're all rolling in it, most of them.
Yeah, but you know, greed is a powerful emotion, isn't it?
Very true, very true.
Direct to consumer, which implies having your own boutique and things like that, is definitely a trend, and it's definitely something that's going to work for some brands. What I have said is that in the future, there's not going to be one way of getting your product to consumer. There's going to be brands that having their own boutiques works for them. There's going to be brands that doing exclusively e-commerce works for them. And there's going to be brands that being in traditional third-party authorized dealers is going to work for them. No brand should see one way as being the option, but at the same time, brands should be open-minded that they need to encourage different potential ways. What cannot happen, what is an enemy, is the publication of all these discounted prices online. We have a last mile problem. So you know this notion of the last mile is always the hardest. The last mile is I've made the decision to purchase a product, meaning I know I want this watch, and I take action to buy it. I go online or I go anywhere to try to buy it. If something blocks me from making that purchase and having too many different prices for the same product online will block me. Going into a dealer and being told, you know, by Rolex, I'm sorry, we don't have this watch. We have no idea we're going to get it. You know, good luck out there, blocks me from buying something. So we have an interesting situation today where there's more ways than ever before to buy a watch, yet there's more choice paralysis, which occurs because a consumer wants to buy that Panerai, sees literally a dozen or two dozen prices for the exact same SKU online, and says, whoa, 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 I don't want to be a fool. I don't want to pay too much, and I also don't want to get screwed. I have no idea which of these prices are good or which of these places I should buy from. So that needs to be cleaned up, because that's one of the massive problems of having, you know, all these discounters. Don't get me wrong, I love a discount, but the sort of culture of discounting has created an enormous problem. It's one of the things that needs to change, because prices need to come down to what's reasonable. Consumers need to feel more comfortable about buying something new. People like us, I mean, I'm if you're like me, you're not going to spend anywhere near retail. Why? It's not because you're cheap, because you know you don't need to. You'd rather save that money to buy more watches. So the long answer is there's a problematic state right now in distribution where people are trying to figure things out. The direct to consumer option of having your own boutiques is going to be a miserable failure for many, many companies, because like you said, those traditional ADs have skills and the ability to understand how to work with clients that the brands will never have. And I look at the car industry in America, which I believe has laws preventing dealerships being owned by the manufacturers. They have to be third parties. It's because of certain monopoly laws. I don't remember the details. I remember learning about it. Mm-hmm. But that is a good example of what happens when you have the requirement of something being sold by a third party as opposed to being sold directly by the manufacturer, because issues happen there. And so I think that this sort of vertically integrated approach can work for very few companies, but not. I think of Louis Vuitton. Louis Vuitton it can work for. Louis Vuitton can spend money on marketing. They have their own stores. They sell other things. Selling exclusively themselves can work for them. But Audemars Piguet, for me, has never demonstrated that they have the ability to effectively market and create relationships with consumers, whereas they can silo themselves and completely get out of the watch community. Because the demand has to be created by people discovering the product. It has to be created by it being part of the sort of watch collector conversation. If they try to silo themselves too much, they're no longer part of that conversation. And the demand engine, which creates people being interested in them, goes away. And I think that's very problematic. So I think there's going to be a mixture of approaches that work in the future. But right now, we are in a very chaotic time where people are trying to figure out what that is. And it's a tough time to be a consumer because we're overwhelmed with choice.
And in the executives that you know and you meet, I mean, feel free to name them, but I suspect you won't want to. Can you see, obviously, the likes of Jean-Claude Biver, who, as you say, is now, you know, largely out of the day-to-day running in the watch world. Can you see some executives in other businesses within the watch world that actually you think, yeah, you do actually understand what the problem is here?
Again, a very good question. The most common question I get, and it's kind of amazing how common it is, it happens every time like clockwork, is something along the lines of, who else is doing it right? What are things that other brands are doing that you like? They're always trying to look laterally, which amuses me because it's the wrong approach for a creative company, right? Like if you want to create something interesting, you look ahead, you don't look laterally. And what, you know, my new answer to them is, you know, who's doing it right? I just say Rolex. And they're like, why? Because they're spending upwards of 40% of their revenue on marketing, and you guys aren't even spending the 20% that you should be spending on. And So that's my answer to them. Rolex is doing things. It's spending. It's doing what it needs to do to get its name out there so people like it and people know about it. You know, a homeless person knows what a Ferrari is. And even though a Ferrari owner won't say it explicitly, one of the reasons they buy a Ferrari is that other people out there know that that means you bought an expensive, cool, flashy car. If nobody knew what Ferrari was that couldn't afford it, the demand for Ferrari goes down. And Rolex has benefited by the fact that you can go into like the middle of nowhere in Africa and someone's like, yes, Rolex, good watch. That is an amazing amount of awareness, and that's what helps to sell luxury products. And so they need to understand that they need to create awareness because that's ultimately where demand comes from. There are individuals that understand this and a lot of the other nuances that would be required to having their brand be successful today. Here's the problem. They oftentimes are not allowed to act. So the individuals, even if they are a CEO or manager that knows what's right for the market, often has to make too many people happy, has to convince a board, has to convince shareholders, has to make a bunch of different, you know, contingencies happy that they can't really execute. So, you know, let's take Panerai, for example, which is, I think, a good example. Panerai is owned by Richemont. Panerai has an office in Milan. They have an office in Neuchâtel. So the CEO of Panerai has four distinct entities, well, maybe five distinct entities they need to make happy. It's the Richemont board, the office in Milan, the office in Neuchâtel, the authorized dealers, and the consumers. How on earth are you going to make all five of those entities happy the exact same time? Can you actually make decisions being stuck all the time? Because any move you make upsets one of those entities. That's a real problem because there's actually too much shared decision-making in the industry, and you need people like Biver, and one of his strengths was he just made decisions. He's like, we're not going to do a study. I'm not going to ask everybody's opinion. We're doing this. Execute, please.
The Steve Jobs mentality.
Precisely, precisely. And we need a lot more of that in the industry. People are running watch brands like banks or financial institutions, and it's hilariously dysfunctional.
I mean, if we were to gather here in 50 years, which is frankly impossible for all of us, but if
impossible
we were
for
to,
you.
It's certainly impossible for me. If we were, would it still be Rolex?
So I believe that when you look at business in general, when you have an environment of consolidation, it's when an industry is in need of massive disruption. Consolidation happens when big companies end up buying other companies in lieu of being able to innovate. And that's what's actually happening here a lot. I think that the way to run a watch brand successfully today and tomorrow is incompatible with the expectations of a publicly traded or shareholder-driven company. Because their needs for growth, their needs for immediate returns do not coincide with the time frames in the watch industry. And I like to bring up models like the Rolex Submariner or the Royal Oak. In today's environment, those watches would never be able to be created. Why? Because shareholders, they don't just want annual results. They want quarterly results. The Royal Oak and the Submariner, in their own ways, took a long, long time to be successful. The Royal Oak took something like 25 years. Audemars Piguet needed to reinvest in essentially a money-losing product year after year after year until suddenly it became successful. Can you see anything like that happening if it was a Richemont brand today where there's shareholders and board members that are looking for quarterly results? They would have dropped the thing a long time ago. There's no way they would have kept investing in it.
And so if you were to pick a brand, if you were to play fantasy watch brand and money was no object, you could take them private so you could have total control, who would you pick?
That's a good question. I've wondered that. I think that one of the things I've sort of made myself aware of is that there's probably no watch brand that today I'd want to work at. It's not that I don't respect a lot of the companies, but just given the culture, given sort of how stiff they are and how difficult it is to get things done. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. I like making decisions and executing. I don't like having to convince a bunch of people. Rolex, for example, as wonderful as they are, they can't move because they need to, like, you know, convince 40 people that something's a good decision. Convincing 30 might be easy, but the other 10, you know, that can be hard. And so I don't know that I would want to put myself in a situation which requires so much diplomacy just to get a creative decision made. I do think that in general, some of the watch brands that are owned by groups will have to be shut down and go into hibernation. I think that there's certain brands, it's time to go to sleep for a while. You know, in the last 10 years, there's all these brands that were brought to life again. Well, some of the brands need to go to sleep for the future where it might be a better environment. So I think there's too many brands right now. And I think that, you know, in the future, look, I mean, I don't know how Richemont feels about, you know, someone like me saying this, but I'm not sure what a group like Richemont adds to the watch industry right now. It definitely was slated to benefit from the watch industry and global watch demand, but is Richemont really in a position to innovate? They are a company who's interested in profit, and I understand that, and they're making investments in brands that give them profit. But right now, they need to reinvest enormous amounts of money, lose money for 5 to 10 years at least, before they can see those types of returns. Are their shareholders going to be okay with that? Probably not. So there isn't one specific brand that I would say, boy, I would really like to run it. But it's more the idea that I would like to be in a position where if I was making decisions about a brand, it's where there's the freedom to spend and to invest and to take risks. I mean, I look at some of the watch ads, you know, from the 60s and 70s and 80s, and we've all seen them. And they're fantastic. They're emotional. They have funny messages. They're sometimes polarizing. I want to be able to make decisions like that. I want to be able to make an ad that you love, but your friend is like turned off by, like, oh, what's that? That type of polarization is key into creating demand for a product that inherently is supposed to say something unique about you. You know, Rolex speaks for you. And I like this notion of, are you wearing a brand or is a brand wearing you? Richard Mille and Rolex, they wear you. Not everyone wants that. Some people want to wear the brand. So I want to be someone who gets to run a company where people wear the brand and I get to continue to invent what that emotion is. I would love to do that, but within the context of a lot of how the brand's operating right now, I would feel stifled. I would feel very stifled. I don't know how much money they'd have to offer me to put up with some of the proposals I'd have to write on a regular basis and the PowerPoint presentations I have to make. I mean, that is the reality of running a watch brand today. It's telling a bunch of people why your decision is going to make sense 3 to 4 years from now. And we don't know. I just want to be able to experiment. We need to be able to put something out there. You know, with the Loco, the Radox watch that I creative directed, I said, let's create a watch that's inspired by a video game, and let's imagine that the watch is meant to be worn by the character in the video game. It's a crazy idea. Can you imagine me getting, like, the board members of Richemont to sign off on that? No, they would hate it. They would hate it. They'd be like, this is insane. Yet, the product on my wrist feels so goddamn satisfying. How would I have been able to convince people beforehand that that would have been the case? So we need to empower creatives. This industry has had a flight of creatives over the last 10 years, and that's a problem. The industry needs to encourage more creative people to come in, and the only way to do that is by giving them real decision-making authority. So if I'm one of those creatives, I will only enter a watch brand if I'm given the authority to do stuff.
Well, that's brilliant.
Thank you very much for, first of all, replying to my email asking if you would like to come on the show, because you could have just ignored it and saved yourself an hour and a quarter. For our listeners, Errol, do you want to tell guys where they can find you, a blog to watch, and your online presences?
Sure, you can go to blogtowatch.com. We have our YouTube channel, we have the website. If you go there, you'll pretty much see everything. We have a pretty popular Instagram page. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to have a lot of fun, and I certainly can't wait to come to Scotland.
Brilliant. That's great. Well, thank you very much for listening in, guys. You can check us out at Scottish Watches on Instagram. Our website is www.scottishwatches.co.uk. We've got a YouTube channel, which you can find if you Google it, because I don't think it is Scottish Watches, but it might be. And I think that's just about it. So,
Thank you, Ariel. Thank you, Ricky. So, as we say in the show, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Bye, everyone. Yeah.